to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
One of the things most of us come to terms with in life is that there's so little that we can control. As a result, we may worry or hold our breath and wonder when the next crisis may occur. Our guest on this episode, author Mary Laura Philpott, has spent a lot of time pondering life and death and everything in between.
Now, you may know Mary Laura from her best-selling book, I Miss You When I Blink, or from her writing in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other respected outlets. Her latest book is called Bomb Shelter, Love, Time, and Other Explosives. Mary Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
What's behind the title of the book and why did you decide to write it?
Thank you. I sort of love the title. This was not the original title of the book. That's why I say I love it, because it came to me a little later in the process. I was writing. Well, let me back up. Let me tell you a little bit about what the book is about so that this will make sense in context.
Okay.
So Bomb Shelter is a memoir, a slice of life memoir about a 2-year period in my life where a lot of the things that had been stable in my life, we were beginning to destabilize. My parents were getting older. My children had turned into teenagers and would soon be leaving the nest. And that felt like a huge change for me to get used to. I had become this middle-aged person with all of these various middle-aged maladies. So I was kind of writing through this time of change in life. And then something happened that kind of kicked it all into a different gear, which was that my oldest child, I have two teenagers, my oldest teenager, my son, had an epileptic seizure out of the blue. We didn't see it coming. We didn't know he had epilepsy. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. And my husband and I woke up to the sound of his body hitting the bathroom floor. And I tell that story in Bomb Shelter, the trip to the hospital, the diagnosis. It's not what the book is about, but it does lend it some narrative drive. So the book is, like you said, and you said this so beautifully, it's about feeling out of control, about not knowing what's coming next, and about finding my way as a human being back to kind of my core personality, which is I'm generally a pretty happy-go-lucky person. I have a good sense of humor. I feel like the world is full of light and things are going to work out. But this had really put me in a dark place. So this story, this overall big story, is built out of smaller stories. It's built out of essays. And midway through the book, I tell a story about a secret I found out about my dad. And you'll understand why I tell the story when I tell you what it's about. So this was just a few years ago. I was in my early 40s on the phone with my dad, and he knew I worked for an independent bookstore then. So he liked to call and make a big deal about how he was ordering books from an independent bookstore. And I mean, sweet, you gotta love dads. And so he said, "Hey, can you order this book for me? It's called Raven Rock by Garrett M. Graff. And it's about these secret underground nuclear bunkers that the government used to run." And I was like, "Oh, Dad, that is so up your alley. Sure, I'll order it for you." And he said, "Oh, great. Thanks. It reminds me of when I used to work there." And I said, "Work where?" And he said, "You know, in the bunker at Raven Rock." And I was 43 years old. He had never mentioned this to me in my life. So, you know, I asked him a bunch more questions. I found out he had worked there as a physician. Basically, it was his job, if the big siren sounded or whatever happened that would indicate an atomic bomb is about to be dropped and we must rush the president and a few other people into this secret bunker, my dad would have been one of the doctors who would have gone into that bunker to keep everyone alive. So he was doing these test runs basically for the end of the world when I was a toddler. This was happening when I was alive. And of course, I didn't know it because I was a toddler. We never know what our parents are going through. But I tell that story as a way of saying sometimes, you know, and Laura, I know you can appreciate this, it's not until we get older that we can appreciate the burdens our parents carried when we were young. And that's a big part of the Bomb Shelter story. I love the idea of these illusions of safety that we build for ourselves. And the very phrase Bomb Shelter, to me, once I came up with it as the title for that chapter, I thought, this is the title for the book. It's got this perfect tension built right in: bomb for the danger and shelter for safety. And that's where we all kind of are, is trying to find our safe space within this wild and crazy, dangerous world.
Unfortunately, our lives share a parallel to yours. I was 27 when I had my first epileptic seizure. We had no family history of it, and it was witnessed by my mom. So I have never been able to imagine what that would have been like for her to watch her adult daughter have this happen and feel so out of control. I know from my perspective, it made me realize how much I had taken for granted and how much I would give to go back to the day before I had that seizure.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your thoughts?
Laura, I'm so glad that you said that about it giving you kind of perspective into what your mom was feeling and what your mom went through. I was so careful in writing Bomb Shelter to try to keep the perspective anchored in my own experience. I'm not here to tell my son's story. I'm not here to, you know, describe what he felt or what he went through. That's his own job to do one day if he would like. This very much, I wanted this very much to be the story of once upon a time, there was a woman who loved control and looking on the bright side and feeling like she knew what was coming next. And then her whole world got turned upside down. And here's what happened next. So it is very much about that mother's experience when it comes to that story. And so I love that it gave you that kind of perspective. I haven't read another book that does that. I mean, specifically for the parent of an epileptic child. So I'm delighted that you read it that way.
We love having you as part of our Nobody Told Me family of listeners. We know a lot of you want to be your own boss or already operate your own business. That's why we want you to know about Shopify.
Hear that? That's the sound of another sale on Shopify. And the moment another business dream becomes reality, Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform that's revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle.
Shopify puts you in control of every sale channel. So whether you're selling satin sheets from Shopify's in-person POS system or offering organic olive oil on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you're covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers.
Once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere.
What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level.
Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 170 countries.
Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/nobody, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/nobody to take your business to the next level today.
Shopify.com/nobody.
Where do you find hope and warmth and joy when you are going through times in life that are making you feel uncomfortable and unstable?
That's a great question. I mean, I find it everywhere. I'm a big, big believer in appreciating the little things, especially when something big is going on. If something big and not pleasant is happening in life, I feel like we've got to take the little hope and joy and humor anywhere we can get it. So, you know, for example, I am somebody who, if I am walking down the sidewalk on, you know, on my way to whatever, a medical appointment, what have you, I will stop and greet every dog I see. And that sounds silly that I'm the woman who talks to every dog, but that makes me so happy. I give compliments. Every person I see who has on a cute pair of shoes, I tell them they have on a cute pair of shoes. I describe this in my book as, I come up with a little term called foresparkling. You know how when in English class you learn about foreshadowing and how when you're reading a book, you can find little hints that tell you something bad is going to happen. Like, you know, the author mentions a teddy bear with its ear torn off, and that is foreshadowing that the family dog is going to die. I try to live my life not necessarily looking for all the foreshadowing of bad things, because I'm already very hyper aware that bad things are out there, but looking for what I call four sparkling little signs of anything good, anything that shows me people are kind, people are careful, people put thought into what they're doing, because I need to believe that the world is a safe, kind, careful place for my family to go out and live in it, you know, to let my kids go out of the nest to walk around out there. I got to believe it's a good world.
I love that because, yeah, I know. I love that because then when the worst thing happens in your life, you can still think to yourself, okay, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to go outside and I'm going to pet those dogs and give compliments. And then there is like that little bit of hope, even in the darkest times.
Yeah.
Do you think it's ever helpful to be worrying about that worst case scenario when we're walking down the street and thinking, oh shoot, well, better enjoy this now. Never know what's going to happen.
I mean, I think it is useful up to a point. You know, if you look at the cover of Bomb Shelter, there is a picture of a turtle, and it's a turtle who lives, it's a wild Eastern box turtle who lives in my yard. We call him Frank. I don't know what his turtle name is, but I put him on the cover because he has what we human beings do not. He has a built-in safety mechanism. He has a shell. We don't have that. What human beings have is our brains and our brains' ability to remember stories about dangerous things that have happened and warn us and help us prepare to avoid those things in the future. So it can be helpful. It is a, you know, a security mechanism to use your brain to go, oh, I've got to think of all the terrible things that could happen so I can be ready. But if you let it get out of control, as I tend to do, and as I did in this time period within Bomb Shelter after some scary things had happened, it can paralyze you. So yeah, I think trying to live in the moment and think about what am I grateful for today is a way to counterbalance that natural instinctive mechanism that our brain is flexing when it's going, look out for all the danger, get prepared.
You know, one of the things that really spoke to me in the book was the part where you suggest that airports ought to have a crying lounge, a place where we could privately fall to pieces and then pull ourselves together again and go back out to face the world. Tell us more about what brought that about.
Yes. I mean, don't you
I agree.
Think they had all these smoking lounges. They don't need those anymore. Nobody smokes in an airport. Think of how nice it would be. We could have all the nice brands of Kleenex, you know, the nice facial tissues that are soft and tea and sunglasses that you could put on. So when you go back in the airport, your eyes don't look like you've been punched in the face. I just feel like airports are this strange liminal space. Everyone in an airport is in between, you know, they're in between where they have just been and where they're going. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the reasons you travel, yes, sometimes it's for vacation and that's great. But often it's for other reasons. It might be for a sad reason, or it might be for a good reason, but oh no, your flight was canceled. Or, you know, you might be going to a reunion and then that's carrying a lot of baggage. I just feel like I'm always crying in an airport. Like I cry in airports probably more than I cry anywhere else. And if I could just have a private place to do it, that would be lovely. The chapter in Bomb Shelter where I suggest that is where I'm telling the story of a few years ago when I had flown down to Augusta, Georgia, where my parents live. I live in Nashville. So I'd flown down there to take care of my parents because my dad had just had an emergency triple bypass operation. And my mom was trying to take care of him by herself and they were tired. And it was the first time ever in my adult life where I really, really felt like I've got to take care of them. Like the role have just reversed. They need care. I'm the one in charge. I have to be there for them. And so I was physically exhausted. I was emotionally exhausted, you know, just absolutely worn down. And when it came time to leave and come back home, which I was very happy to do, and I felt like, okay, they're going to be all right. They're stable. My flight was delayed again and again and again over the course of like a day and a half. So the final flight where they actually kicked us off the plane and they were like, nope, this plane's not taking off today. I remember just getting off that plane, walking to the into the airport, sitting down on the first chair I could find, which was in this little next to a little coffee cart, and just putting my head on my balled up fists and not even sobbing, just melting, like just liquefying and thinking, I just wish there were a place I could sit and do this because I cannot take another step until I have a good cry.
So you feel like it's a good idea to feel that sadness and not try to push it away?
I mean, I can't push it away.
Yeah, I can't that, either.
I know there are people who are, my husband is one. He's really good at like holding the emotions back until the proper time. And I don't know if I've just gotten more sensitive with age. I think that's part of it. When I was younger, I was more cynical. And now I think my emotions all live closer to the surface. And part of that is age and awareness of mortality. And part of that is being a mother and having these, you know, two children who are becoming adults and caring so much about them. And part of it, I think, is just being a human being, which means you are this human soul trapped in a mortal body, loving other human beings who are also human souls trapped in mortal bodies. I mean, that just carries this enormous weight. And it's just right under the surface for me all the time. So yes, I am someone who will both laugh and cry just right there when it washes over me.
You know, you write, I keep trying to make sense of my life by stacking stories upon stories upon stories. I do that too. And why do you think that's helpful?
You know, I think some people do it more than others, and it makes perfect sense to me that you do as well. I mean, here we are on a podcast where you are actually like collecting people's stories and using them to make sense out of life. I think, you know, like I think the storytelling urge is a very human thing. And it again goes back to the genetic gift that we have. Our security mechanism is our brain. Our brain takes information and makes stories out of it to help keep us alive. You know, go back to the cave times and you've got stories told around the cave fire of, here is the story of so-and-so who ate the purple berries that grow on that bush over there and he died. So don't let that happen to you. You know, we do that with our brains. I think I crave order and tidiness, and I like for things to have a purpose. And I love to think that there's some sort of beginning, middle, and moral of the story in whatever I'm going through. And although I know that that is not always the case, a lot of times things happen that are truly random. A lot of things happen that don't have, you know, some special meaning. You know, people say, oh, everything happens for a reason. I don't know that things do, but I think my mind kind of wishes they do. And so putting together stories like I do in this book, like I did in my other book, where I'm stacking essays up to tell a bigger story, helps me take the chaos of life and get a little something orderly out of it. Take something away from it that makes me feel like, okay, well, at least I learned something from all this as I go forward.
One of my favorite things that you say in the book, because I think it just encompasses how we all feel so well, is you say, I'm obsessed with death because I'm in love with life. When did you have that realization and how did it change how you viewed the world, the challenges, the good parts, all of it?
Oh, thank you for calling out that line. That came to me while writing this book. There's a lot in Bomb Shelter that I had sort of figured out and sorted out before I started writing, that I was like, okay, I'm ready to tell this story because I've got some things to say that I've figured out. And then there were other things that I actually figured out as I was writing. And I remember writing a scene where I was reflecting on, I'd been in the hospital with my son for one of his checkups, and you know, he goes to a children's hospital because he was a teenager when all this started, but he is a full-grown man-sized human. So it's hysterical to take him into this children's hospital where he's like Goldilocks in the Three Bears cabin where everything is too small. And we were in this exam room that had Finding Nemo stickers on the wall from the little Finding Nemo movie. And it was, I was writing about that visit to the hospital when I kind of started going down this little rabbit hole of, it's so funny to me that he is this full-size man in an exam room with Finding Nemo stickers. I remember the first time I saw Finding Nemo. Actually, it was right after he was born. I was just a few weeks postpartum, and there was this great new animated movie in theaters, and I thought, this will be fun, and I went to it. Of course, we all know what happens at the beginning of Finding Nemo. The mother is eaten by a barracuda while trying to protect her eggs. So with all those hormones, you know, surging through my body, I had started sobbing in the little animated movie and then laughing at the fact that I was sobbing in an animated movie. And this is where my brain went as I was telling this story. And it made this little light bulb moment for me where I was like, well, that's it. That's why I was sobbing so hard in this animated movie about a fish being eaten by a barracuda. She loved her babies and she was trying to protect them. And that's why it's so sad to me. And I love my babies and I love life. I love being alive. And that's why the thought of all the things that endanger our lives makes me cry. And I don't mean to be a person who cries all the time, but the whole reason I cry all the time is because I love being here. And I love the fact that my loved ones are here and I don't want any of that to go away. So that was something that I actually came to as I was writing.
And you write that you have been mothered by stand-ins more often than you can count. Tell us more about that and how it's helped you.
Yes. I will do a little digression here and tell you a cute story. So I mentioned being mothered by stand-ins during a chapter where I'm writing about some other young people that I sort of had a stand-in mothering moment with. And I talk about how back in my 20s, I used to watch the Food Network on TV when I got home from work. And this was before the Food Network was like weird game shows about how much hot sauce can you eat. It used to be instructive and it was like shows that taught you how to cook. And there was this show called Cooking Live with Sarah Moulton. And it was every evening for either an hour or half an hour. And she just made dinner on the screen and you could cook along with her or you could just watch. But it was so instructive and so soothing. And I was a brand new adult out in my first job with my first little briefcase, coming home to my empty house every night. And to me, it was almost like she was mothering me through this show. And I write about that in Bomb Shelter. When the book came out, I sent her a copy. I tracked her down through her website and I sent her a copy. And she wrote me back and she said she read it and she loved it. And so I've had this whole full circle moment with, you know, my TV mom from 20 years ago. But I feel like that's the best of humanity right there. When we are, whether we know it or not, doing things that nurture other people or that make the world a little bit gentler for other people. And if nothing else, if we're looking for a guiding principle and how to behave and how to act and what to say and what to do, choose the thing that makes life a little gentler for other people. Be that stand-in parental figure for somebody sometime, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I'm 31 and I feel like I'm still looking to people for that kind of motherly or paternal guidance. Do you think that we ever really stop growing up and feeling like we need that?
Oh gosh, no. I think that goes on forever. I mean, somebody on the publishing team for this book described it in a meeting once as something like, this is a book about the ways you keep growing long after you're grown up, because I think we are always in the process of growing up. And I know people well ahead of me in life. I know people in their 50s and 60s whose parents have just recently passed away and they describe themselves as new orphans. You know, they say, I've been orphaned. I've lost my parents. And you think, well, how could you need parents? You're well into adulthood. We all just need to know that somebody is looking out for us. Somebody has our back. Somebody would make sure to catch us if we fell. And because we don't all literally have our parents around to do that in every scenario, we have to kind of be that for each other.
What are your thoughts on how the pandemic has impacted you and your view of life and the world in general?
Oh man, I think it's going to be a while until we know all the ways that it has changed people, but it definitely has changed people. I mean, you look at the statistics on how many people quit their jobs during the pandemic, not because they lost their jobs, but because they actually had this life is short. Oh my gosh, what am I doing in this, you know, position I don't want to have anymore kind of moment. I think it did make a lot of us reckon with, okay, this, like, people are dying by the thousands right now. I get this one life. How do I want to spend it? I think also, and this is funny, but you know, we all got used to things being canceled for a while. Like, you know, travel is canceled, spring break is canceled. A lot of the things you counted on doing are not going to happen. Everything switched to virtual. I think it freed us up to say no and cancel things. I think it freed us up to say, I don't want to do that anymore. And a lot of us, I can speak for myself, I used to feel this sense of obligation to do things that I didn't even want to do. And I would think, well, I have to go. I've got to go to this party because I'm supposed to. Somebody's expecting me there. No, I don't. I think we all kind of learned that in the pandemic, and it's sort of wonderful.
I agree. Yeah. I haven't heard anybody say that, but it's really true.
Yeah. You know what?
At the end of each show, we always ask our guests, what is your nobody told me lesson? So what did nobody tell you about moving forward when really our beginning and end and everything in between is and feels like it's out of our control that you wish you'd known before and you'd like to pass on to our audience?
I love that. And I love that you do show. I think I wish I could go back and tell myself, and I sort of wish somebody had told me, although I don't know that I would have believed it. I think I had to learn it myself, that a lot of the things I thought of as deadlines or finish lines or goalposts were just illusions. That there is no point if you're holding your breath and going, I'll wait and be happy once such and such happens, once I reach this age or status or job promotion or what have you. If there's something you're holding out as the when this happens, I'll be happy, that is not going to work because the finish line is always moving. So you've got to find happiness and peace that's not attached to those finish lines. I think that's what I wish I could go back and tell myself.
And Mary Laura, how can people connect with you on social media and the internet and find out more about your work?
Well, I have a newsletter that I send out periodically, and you can sign up for that on my website, which is just marylaurafilpott.com. Social media, probably the one I use most is Instagram. I am also on Facebook and Twitter, but Instagram's the one I actually check like almost every day.
All right, super. Well, we thank you so much for joining us. This has really been a lot of fun to talk with you. And it's also been really thought-provoking because, you know, you're showing us how things have unfolded in your life. And there are a lot of commonalities, I think, with all of us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
We did too. Again, our sincere thanks to Mary Laura Philpott, whose new book is called Bomb Shelter, Love, Time, and Other Explosives. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate. But you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.